Hi, I'm Jeff Ranke, Editorial Director of Manufacturing.net and Manufacturing Business Technology. Welcome to Security Breach. When discussing the industrial sector's threat landscape, we often detail events that result from vulnerabilities discovered by hackers probing for soft spots within an organization's networks, connected infrastructure, or data storage centers. However, taking a look at Newspire's latest threat landscape report reiterates the need for manufacturers to keep their defenses up, even when working with documents, files, or websites that would appear to have limited interest from hackers and no connection points to outside parties. Newspire reported a 28% increase in malware attacks, or about 52,000 detections a day during the second quarter of 2022. While many are being detected and blocked before even being seen by the user, some are getting through by disguising themselves as add-ons or support tools from Microsoft Office documents. Once the user clicks for additional information within these software programs, which contain embedded online connections and providing legitimate support and downloadable tools, the malware is downloaded, providing a gateway to any and all of the user's network, cloud, system, and software connections. During the same period, the company reported a 100% increase in botnet activity, reaching a rate of nearly 20,000 attacks per day. This form of malware attaches itself to web pages and emails. Once it's unintentionally downloaded by the targeted user clicking on a link or agreeing to download a false asset, the bug can log keystrokes, instilling login and other personal information that often feeds into ransomware attacks. Joining us to discuss these ongoing threats is Mike Pedrick, VP of Cybersecurity Consulting for Newspire, a leading managed security services provider. So, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate you taking the time. Sort of jumping right into things here, in reviewing the latest threat landscape report that you guys put out, you talked about a huge uptick in malware and these types of attacks. What can you tell us about some of the strategies or the way that the malware is being introduced into these systems? And maybe looking more specifically at the industrial sector, how big of a threat is it specifically to manufacturing?
Well, there's a couple of things to unpack there. In general terms, I think that we're seeing a malware as part of a larger scale attack vector, right? There's always been the spray and pray methodology of distributing malware. I'm going to send out this malicious code. Wherever it lands, and I'll deal with whatever happens from there. But now it's part of a larger concerted effort by organized groups, ransomware gangs, cybercrime gangs, even, you know, gangs for hire, cybercrime for hire organizations. Now, specific to the industrial sector, we saw, you know, even the famous Columbia pipeline compromise. Why do I feel like I've got that name wrong? Anyway,
Colonial.
Pipeline compromise it was a huge success from the perspective of those who want to compromise those sorts of environments, right? And take advantage of some of the, you know, potentially lax control structures in those organizations. And that's not to throw industrial orgs under the bus. It's just the simple truth of the matter is we haven't had historically the need to protect the industrial sector to the extent that we have the financial industry, healthcare organizations, et cetera. But attackers, opportunistic and state funded, are finding tremendous opportunities in taking down industrial organizations and some of the potential for capitalizing on what it means when availability is the target instead of confidentiality.
Yeah, it's interesting when you say malware to the industrial sector. I think a lot of people think like Stuxnet, they think about bad USBs and things like that. But these folks are using some really more complex tactics than that. What are some of the strategies that you've encountered in really working with folks, and how are they going about implanting this malware into their systems?
It's a lot of leverage, or it's intended to be leverage from the perspective of the attackers against individuals, right? And I hesitate to speak in terms of absolutes, but I want to say that across all the attack vectors, what we're seeing is more of a drive toward, I'm not trying to compromise a system, I'm trying to compromise environments, right? I'm trying to use the systems and the technologies that are in place to get what I want, right? And in general terms, if I can get a small application, a small bit of script into an environment such that it does one thing, here's this step in the process. I'm trying to get in, I'm trying to get a foothold, and then I can move from one system to another within that environment. You know, for example, I'm not interfacing directly with ICS systems or SCADA systems, et cetera. But if I can get a small bit of script into somebody's laptop who's out on site or makes a site visit on a regular basis, et cetera, then I'm going to try to do that, right? And so delivery mechanisms are largely what you might expect them to be. Hey, here's this email, click here. Or how can I compromise somebody's identity in, you know, cloud-based platforms, AWS, Azure, et cetera, and then land those malicious scripts into the environment to get to that next step in the process, right? And like I said, this is part of a larger concerted effort where the goal isn't the malware, but the malware contributes to that that ultimate goal.
No, it makes a lot of sense. You know, another thing called out in the report, and it was no surprise, manufacturing has become the favorite target of a lot of these groups. A couple that the report also talked about was Lockbit and Dynamite Panda, and these are ransomware groups specifically. Can you tell us anything about these groups and some of the tactics that they might prefer?
Yeah, I can speak to ransomware groups in general. Lockbit is allegedly a state-sponsored organization out of Russia. Dynamite Panda, of course, out of China. You might be inclined to draw parallels between those two organizations based on the fact that they have a common, potentially common victims. I don't know, you know, again, allegedly there's no connectivity between those two gangs, but, you know, anything is possible at this point. But it does open us up to the idea that, you know, these may be state-funded, state-sponsored organizations. At the very least, they are, you know, in jurisdictions that are where attribution is going to be very challenging and prosecution is also going to be very, very challenging. Now, in generalized terms, again, ransomware gangs, their goal, let me put it in simple terms, the goal is to get paid, really, right? And so they're going to leverage whatever they can to get that payment, to get that money, that ransom payment. And so what I've been finding over the last several years is that the deployment of ransomware is just the point at which they're ready to get loud. They're ready to do the thing that is the ultimate leverage against the victim to get paid for that compromise. It's a business, realistically speaking. You know, we've all heard, of course, that some of the tactics have sort of changed. Rather than just getting into an environment, deploying ransomware and demanding money, you know, in that simplistic model, theoretically, the victim could say, you know what, I got backups, or I don't care about the data that you encrypted, go away, I'm not paying this money, right? Instead, again, the gangs will establish a foothold in the environment, teach themselves how to use some of the tools that are available within that environment, enumerate the network, identify where all the bodies are buried, so to speak, where's the good data to get a hold of, and then help themselves to some of that information. So that when you do get when you do see the ransomware go off, if you respond back by saying, I don't want to pay, they can say, well, we think you're going to come around to paying because we've helped ourselves to this data. And so if you tie it back to industrial systems, you know, core, you know, utility systems, for example, that conversation, it's no longer feasible to say, I'm not going to pay this money. It's, you know, how much money is going to get this done if the threat is we've got our fingers on the button to shut down this utility or shut down this key system, or, you know, you no longer have access, wireless, you know, cellular access to systems you've got out in the field.
Yeah, it's amazing how complex these organizations have become, even to the point where they'll take some of this data they've stolen and given it to different people who specialize in different areas of ransom, if you will, in terms of whether it's login information, IP, whatever the case is. As these ransomware groups have gotten more complex, Mike, what are some things that can be done then to address them in these new tactics? What are some things that you've experienced?
I think the first thing I would say, and it sounds a little bit cliche in my head because I feel like I've said it a lot, is that there's definitely something attractive about hearing about new things, new technologies, new compromise vectors, right? There's a lot of news recently around the notion of multi-factor authentication fatigue attacks, which is a tactic used by attackers to just, I'm constantly going to send you MFA push notifications until you either, you know, in a fit of frustration hit OK, or you accidentally hit OK when you meant to hit no, et cetera, right? We hear about these novel attack vectors while not really paying attention to some of the more subtle but basic foundational compromises. You know, if our patching acumen is not up to snuff and somebody compromises a system leveraging an old vulnerability, it's fairly embarrassing. The extreme example I often give is, if you remember the Melissa virus or the I Love You virus from the early days of Exchange 5.5, try to imagine the egg on somebody's face if their company had the Melissa virus today, right? Oh my gosh, would that be embarrassing? There's no way the Melissa virus is going to find a foothold in my environment today. It's just not going to be a thing. Realistically speaking, we're seeing some of these behavioral issues where patching acumen or incident response protocols that they're just not up to snuff. They haven't met the standard of care threshold in my mind. So again, it's do all the basics really, really well. Now, specific to ransomware, have good backups, have good alert mechanisms, alerting and notification mechanisms. Respect the fact that no matter how rudimentary you think your, SCADA systems, your ICS systems, et cetera, no matter how rudimentary you think they are, somebody thinks that they're, something to target, something to capitalize on, right? So think in terms of, what would somebody do or what would I do if I wanted to compromise this system? And man, everything is on the table. There's no holds barred there, right?
Yeah.
And then just take a look at where those systems fall into the larger architecture of the environment and what they could do if they were down. That's the best advice I can give folks, is pay attention, dot your I's, cross your T's, go back to basics if you have to, and make sure that those things are tight. And 9 times out of 10, you'll be better off, right? It's the old adage, you don't have to outrun the bear, you just have to outrun your buddy running next to you. That's good for opportunists. Of course, targeted attacks where they know what they're looking for, they know they want to compromise your environment, that's a bird of a different feather. And realistically speaking, that comes down to having good incident response protocols, carrying the insurance that you need to, and recognizing that there's no, risk never reaches zero. Something can always happen, and be ready if it does.
Absolutely. One of the points you just made there, I think, is really interesting about people being worried about having an egg on their face a little bit as being targeted and having to pay some of these ransoms. There's a push right now for legislation that would demand organizations to report these attacks, so that at least at a minimum, there is an organization within the government that's aware of them, can track them, can see what's happening, and maybe even an internal community that can share best practices. What are your thoughts there on really urging organizations to make these attacks known and getting more information out there about them?
When we can share freely, openly, and any actionable information we have about our own compromises, the bad guys are working together. The bad guys are working outside the rules, outside the bounds of noble activity. Why can't we work collaboratively? Why can't we share, this is what happened, this is how they got us, don't do this, whatever this is, right? Without fear of reproach. Now, in order for that to be possible, we also have to be insulated a little bit from some of the more litigious folks in the industry, right? We're opening ourselves up to liability potentially if we say that we had this vulnerability, we missed the mark on this particular control framework, and as a result, we were compromised. We know better, we're doing better now, et cetera. But it opens us up to potential legal liability at that point. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to get to that point where we can do so freely. I would embrace it. I think that it would be fantastic. I do envision a future where an organization could say, yes, we were compromised, but this is what we did to shore ourselves up. This is why we're committed to improving the program and maybe not firing the CISO as the opening salvo for recovery.
No, makes sense. You just want to circle back to it. I have to ask this to everybody who comes on the show. Ransomware. When you face these situations, do you pay the ransomware attacker? Do you pay him to get what you need?
If you strip the emotional component, because obviously you're always going to be thinking in the back of your mind, did I just finance terrorism? Did I just finance this organization? Is the next attack more likely because I funded their next 15 months of payroll, I guess? And I can't answer that. In cold, unemotional terms, if it costs you less to pay the ransom than it would cost you to recover, it's on the table. That's just how it is, right? I don't know that I would ever look a client in the face and say, if it's pay the ransom or close your doors forever and put everybody on the payroll, back out onto the market. They don't have a job as of tomorrow. If those are the choices, call your insurance provider, pay the ransom, right?
Yeah.
The rebuke to that is that there's, especially early on in the history of ransomware, there was this notion that you can pay the ransom. Maybe they'll give you the decryption package. Maybe they won't, but you're definitely out the money. There's no hope for attribution. There's no hope for finding these folks. And so the money is just gone, guaranteed. But you have to look at this through the lens of, again, business, right? It doesn't do them any good to not give you back your data if you pay, because that circulates as well. These guys are unscrupulous. I paid the money. I didn't get my ransom back. And so the next victim is going to say, you're not giving it back to me anyway. Forget it.
Right.
And so their answer has been, they have service desks. They have people ready to help you out, jump into the chat window and teach you how to convert, traditional currency into Bitcoin to pay the ransom to, here's how the decryption tool works, et cetera. It is a massive business because, they succeed. They get paid.
No, it's incredible. When I first discovered that as well, that there are, customer relations basically at these ransomware groups. They have human resource people out there actively recruiting new hackers to come on board. It's impressive and frightening at the same time in terms of how they've scaled and how much more complex they've become. We've talked a lot about the bad guys here, Mike. Let's talk about some of the good guys. What can you tell me about some of the work you and your colleagues at Newspire are doing?
Sure, absolutely. So in addition to our, subscribed managed services, we do a lot of endpoint detection and response, a lot of managed incident response processes, et cetera. We also have a consulting team of subject matter experts that are always entirely too eager to sit down with the organization and talk through their program from a holistic perspective, right? This is everything from, strategy, long-term strategy, to here's where I see some gaps in your program that I think somebody could capitalize on, et cetera. It's the Sherpa up the mountain, so to speak, that these consultants are presenting themselves as. And so, and then as we talked about at the, previously, there's obviously the newsletter, the reports, the threat reports that we publish. We're really trying to drive forward with information for our clients and organizations that perhaps aren't our clients yet, but that we want to help them out. We don't believe there's a one size fits all. We try to meet our clients where they live. This is our baseline understanding. This is what's important to us. Here's our risk profile. Please help us close the gaps accordingly. No two organizations are going to have exactly the same perspective on the subject matter.
Absolutely. Mike, I want to touch on something else that was brought up in the report in terms of sort of a step to take in helping prevent a lot of the vulnerabilities that were discussed. And one of them that stood out to me was disabling unused services. Could you maybe expand on that a little bit? I think that's one that seems like very obvious, but potentially go overlooked and cause some problems.
There's two reasons we want to take a look at disabling services. Of course, a lot of folks are familiar with the concept of least privilege. Well, there's also the concept of least functionality. And again, there's two lenses to look at that through. The first is, anything that you don't use on a regular basis, you don't need, right? Again, the analog under least privilege is if there's data that you don't use as part of your job, you don't need access to it. And that limits the bleeding, so to speak, if somebody compromises your account. It's the same scenario with services. Now I'll pick on Print Spooler because Print Spooler always leaves my head, you know, leaves me scratching my head when I see Print Spooler enabled on servers. Where are you going to print? And what are you printing? You know, why is that enabled, right? For the one time every 10 years, you feel like you have to print something from, you know, a core server in an environment, go enable the print server, identify the printer, send the thing, whatever. But realistically speaking, it's 2022. Print Spooler just is not necessary in so many of these places. But there has recently been vulnerabilities identified in the Print Spooler service. You know, the attackers can leverage this. And so, you know, it's also, this is the other point I want to make, it's also emblematic of a strong level of maturity from a program perspective, right? That we didn't leave that door open. We didn't do this thing that leaves us potentially open, right? Before you go to bed at night, you make your rounds through the house, you make sure the front door is locked, you make sure the back door is locked, you know, so on and so forth. But there's a random basement window that's, you know, unlocked and, you know, cracked 3/4 of an inch and has been for the last 3 months, right? That's how we perceive things like not limiting services that you don't need in systems. It's fine if, you know, again, the application server has access to printers, specific printers, check printers, for example, for accounting processes, but the domain controller, that's illogical, right? So again, there's maturity in making sure that you only have what you need.
No, it makes a ton of sense. You know, the report was great. It talked a lot about malware, botnets. We've talked about ransomware here. Looking forward, Mike, 12 to 18 months, what do you see as either being some new emerging threats or things that are continuing to be a challenge for the industrial sector when it comes to cybersecurity?
12 to 18 months is a heartbeat, as far as I'm concerned. So I think that ransomware will continue to be an issue, even though we're seeing some statistics that suggest that it's leveled off and or maybe going down. I think that there's going to be probably some more implications from a data privacy perspective, especially for industrial organizations. I think it's a little bit of a blind spot for a lot of utility organizations, not necessarily realizing what is in their control that is identified as sensitive information, personally identifiable information, et cetera. So I think that as utility organizations, industrial organizations, even manufacturers are fighting from their heels from a data security perspective or a system security perspective rather, data security and data privacy is right around the bend.
Thanks, Mike. For more information on the work Newspire does, you can go to newspire.com. Thanks for joining us today. To catch up on past episodes, you can go to manufacturing.net, IEN.com, or MBTMag.com. You can also check Security Breach out wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple, Amazon, and Overcast. For Mike Piedrick, I'm Jeff Ranke, and this is Security Breach.